You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to lumbar spine anatomy, pediatric osteomyelitis, and biopsy principles, which are three topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with lumbar spine anatomy. First question. A 68-year-old is undergoing lateral lumbar interbody fusion using the trans-psoas approach. Which of the following statements is true regarding the safe approach zone for this procedure as you move cranial to caudal in the lumbar spine? And the choices are 1. Safe approach zone increases due to vessels moving more ventral. 2. Safe approach zone increases due to lumbar plexus moving more dorsal. 3. Safe approach zone decreases due to vessels moving more dorsal. 4. Safe approach zone decreases due to lumbar plexus moving more ventral. And 5. Safe approach zone remains the same throughout the lumbar spine. So this is kind of a difficult question. As you move cranial to caudal in the lumbar spine, the safe approach zone for the lateral trans-psoas approach decreases due to the more ventral position of the lumbar plexus. So the correct answer to this question is 4. The safe approach zone decreases due to the lumbar plexus moving more ventral as you move cranial to caudal in the lumbar spine. So to briefly review, the lateral lumbar interbody fusion has become more common for degenerative spine disorders and adjacent segment degeneration. This trans-psoas approach is typically useful for pathology from the L1 to L2 disc space to the L4-L5 disc space and places the lumbar plexus at risk. Working at the more caudal disc spaces is especially difficult given the more ventral position of the plexus, but the use of triggered EMG retractors and probes can help prevent nerve injuries. Surgical approach can be especially difficult in patients with rotational deformities. Benglis et al. Did a cadaver study with specimens placed lateral to trace the course of the lumbar plexus. They found that the plexus moves more ventral with respect to the disc space, moving more caudal in the lumbar spine. Park et al. Used 10 cadaver specimens to measure the distance of the lumbar nerve roots from the center of the disc space in the lateral approach. While disc space access was generally safe, there was less distance to the nerve root for more caudal disc levels. Regev et al. Did an MRI study to evaluate the safe working corridor for the lateral approach. The safe zone narrows considerably in the L4-L5 disc space due to more ventral position of the nerve roots, and they recommend careful monitoring when addressing this level. Next question. A patient with severe multi-level spinal stenosis is scheduled to undergo decompression and fusion from T12 to L4. Both pedicle screw length and diameter are measured preoperatively. Which of the following pedicles would be templated for the smallest diameter screw? And the choices are 1, T12, 2, L1, 3, L2, 4, L3, and 5, L4. So pedicle screws are often used for spine stabilization procedures in both elective and trauma situations. Understanding of pedicle anatomy is essential to safe and effective screw placement. Ibrahim et al. In their studies investigated pedicle dimensions of thoracic and lumbar spine, including linear and angular measurements, as well as the average distance from the projection point of the lumbar pedicle axis to the midline of the transverse process. So the smallest pedicle diameter was most consistently found at the L1 level. The information from their studies can be helpful during preoperative templating and operative placement of screws into lumbar and thoracic pedicles. So the correct answer to this question is 2. The L1 pedicle would be templated for the smallest diameter screw. Next question. Which of the following areas of the vertebral segment has the highest ratio of cortical to cancellous bone? And the choices are 1. Thoracic vertebral bodies, 2. Lumbar vertebral bodies, 3. Sacrum, 4. Pedicles of the lower lumbar spine, and 5. Pedicles of the thoracic spine. So the weight-bearing potential of bone is influenced by the ratio of cortical to cancellous bone. The area of the spinal anatomy that has the highest ratio is the pedicles of the thoracic spine. This is followed by the lumbar pedicles. The vertebral bodies have a lower ratio than the pedicles, with the sacrum having the very lowest ratio. So the correct answer to this question is 5 pedicles of the thoracic spine. Next question. A urologist has requested the operative report for a 41-year-old male that underwent L5-S1 anterior lumbar interbody fusion using bone morphogenic protein 2 augmentation. Which of the following urologic complications occurs most commonly after this surgery? And the choices are 1. Erectile dysfunction, 2. Recurrent urinary tract infections, 3. Retrograde ejaculation, 4. Testicular atrophy, and 5. Penile numbness. So retrograde ejaculation is a well-known complication of anterior lumbar interbody fusion techniques, with a documented incidence of 7-10%. Retrograde ejaculation occurs most commonly after ALIF surgery due to mechanical or inflammatory injury to the superior hypogastric plexus near the aortic bifurcation. While the evidence is conflicting, some studies suggest a higher rate of retrograde ejaculation in ALIF procedures using bone morphogenic protein 2 augmentation. Other complications of ALIF include pseudoarthrosis and subsidence, vascular injury, the left iliac is most commonly injured, ileus, and lymphoseal, otherwise known as a chyloretroperitoneum. Tepper et al. Performed a prospective study evaluating the incidence of retrograde ejaculation after anterior lumbar interbody fusion. They found that the use of RHBMP2 was not related to an increased incidence of retrograde ejaculation. In their series 4 patients, that is 9.8% of the patients studied, were diagnosed with retrograde ejaculation based on the laboratory analysis. Lindley et al. Compared the incidence of retrograde ejaculation after ALIF with artificial disc replacement versus fusion with the use of RHBMP2. They found that postoperative retrograde ejaculation occurred in 4 of the 54 ALIF patients, that is 7.4%, and in 4 of the 41 artificial disc replacement patients, that is 9.8%, which was not statistically significant. Sasso et al. Found that a transperitoneal approach to the lumbar spine at L4, L5, and L5-S1 has a 10 times greater chance of causing retrograde ejaculation in men than a retroperitoneal approach. So the answer to this question is obviously 3, retrograde ejaculation. And the final question for this topic, a surgeon is planning to place an anterior interbody device in the lumbar spine using a retroperitoneal approach. A vertebral body is identified directly posterior to the bifurcation of the aorta. What is the most likely level of this vertebral body? And the choices are 1, L2, 2, L3, 3, L4, 4, L5, and 5, S1. So the level of the bifurcation of the great vessels can vary, but most commonly is located at or near the L4 vertebral body. Direct anterior exposure of the L4-L5 disc space usually requires lateral retraction of the great vessels. Exposure of the L5-S1 disc space usually can be performed by working in between the bifurcation of the aorta. Hoppenfeld's surgical exposures states, quote, "The aorta divides on the anterior surface of the L4 vertebra into the two common iliac arteries. Just below this bifurcation, the common iliac vessels divide in turn at about the S1 level into the internal and external iliac vessels," end quote. Kamenarong et al. Showed in a study of 197 cadavers that, quote, "the abdominal aorta descended and bifurcated into two common iliac arteries at the level of the L4 vertebra in 131 cases, that is 70.1% of the patients studied, at the fourth lumbar intervertebral disc in 23 cases, that is 12.3% of patients studied, and at the level of the L5 vertebra in 33 cases, that is 17.6% of the patients studied. So the correct answer to this question is 3. L4 is the vertebral body identified directly posterior to the bifurcation of the aorta. Moving on to the topic of pediatric osteomyelitis. The first question reads, an 8-year-old girl presents to the emergency room with a 4-day history of limp and temperature of 100.7 Fahrenheit. Lab results show a white blood cell count of 13,000, with the reference range being 4,500 to 11,000. a hematocrit of 33%, the reference range being 41 to 50%, and a C-reactive protein of 14 milligrams per liter, with the reference range being 0.08 to 3.1 milligrams per liter. MR imaging demonstrates osteomyelitis of the proximal tibia without an abscess. During the workup in the emergency room, the patient became hypotensive. What is the mechanism of action of the empiric antibiotic appropriate for this patient? And the choices are 1. Binding to penicillin-specific binding proteins in the bacterial cell wall. 2. Binding to the D-ALA-D-ALA residues in the bacterial cell wall. 3. Inhibition of bacterial topoisomerase and DNA gyrase. 4. Inhibition of nucleic acid synthesis. And 5. Binding to 30S ribosomal proteins. So the patient described presents with osteomyelitis most likely due to methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA. Empiric antibiotics for suspected MRSA infections include clindamycin and vancomycin, and vancomycin is recommended for severe infections, particularly with signs of sepsis. The mechanism of action of vancomycin is binding to the D-ALA-D-ALA moieties to inhibit bacterial cell wall synthesis. So the correct answer to this question is 2, binding to the D-ALA-D-ALA residues in the bacterial cell wall. MRSA infections have been increasingly common causes of osteomyelitis and require appropriate antibiotic coverage for proper treatment. MRSA infections can often be more aggressive and progress more rapidly than MSSA infections. Ju et al. Describe a clinical prediction algorithm for distinguishing MRSA from MSSA osteomyelitis in children. They report 4 patient factors: a temperature of greater than 38 degrees Celsius, a white blood cell count of greater than 12,000, hematocrit of less than 34, and CRP of greater than 13 as being associated with MRSA infection. Patients with all 4 factors are found to have a 92% chance of MRSA infection, 42% for patients with 3 out of 4 factors. Copley presents a review of pediatric musculoskeletal infections discussing proper imaging during workup, often involving MRI, and proper antibiotic management after debridement, often parenteral, followed by oral antibiotics. Recommended antibiotics for empiric treatment include ampicillin sulbactam and gentamicin for patients less than 1 month old, vancomycin and ceftriaxone for those 1 to 3 months old, and clindamycin, vancomycin, or rifampin for other pediatric/adolescent patients. The authors note that vancomycin is the antibiotic of choice for suspected sepsis/severe infection, but clindamycin for less severe cases in areas where methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus is more prevalent. So to quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1 is incorrect, as binding to penicillin-specific binding proteins in the bacterial cell wall describes the mechanism of oxacillin, which would be inadequate in the treatment of MRSA osteomyelitis. Answer 3 is incorrect, as inhibition of bacterial topoisomerase and DNA gyrase describes the mechanism of fluoroquinolone antibiotics. Answer 4 is incorrect, as inhibition of nucleic acid synthesis describes the mechanism of metronidazole. And answer 5 is incorrect, as binding to the 30S ribosomal proteins describes the mechanism of aminoglycoside antibiotics. The mechanism of clindamycin involves inhibition at the 50S subunit of the ribosome. Next question. In children, a diagnosis of osteomyelitis with concomitant deep venous thrombosis has a high association with which causative organism? And the choices are 1. Kingella kingae, 2. Mycobacterium tuberculosis, 3. Methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, 4. Methicillin-sensitive Staphylococcus aureus, and 5. Salmonella. So DVT in association with musculoskeletal infection is most likely caused by methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA, which is the correct answer to this question. Risk factors for DVT in the pediatric population include age older than 8 years old, a CRP of greater than 6 milligrams per liter, presence of MRSA-associated infection, as well as a need for surgical intervention. While a malignant process remains on the differential, with a relatively acute onset of presentation, fever, and the associated positive blood cultures, infection, specifically osteomyelitis, remains at the top of the differential. Holmig et al. Retrospectively assessed 212 children with a diagnosis of osteomyelitis over a two-year period. 11 of the children had both DVT and osteomyelitis when compared to the non-DVT group, had significantly higher CRP of greater than 6 mg per liter, were older, greater than 8 years old, and had a higher rate of MRSA as the causative agent, that was 73% versus 24%. Gonzalez et al. Prospectively followed 9 children with concomitant DVT and MRSA-associated osteomyelitis. Notable associations were increased ICU admissions, invasive procedures, and a propensity to cause septic emboli. Also, the most common location for DVT was the femoral vein, with extension into the popliteal system. Next question. Sequestrum is defined as which of the following? And the choices are 1. Reactive bone in acute osteomyelitis, 2. Reactive bone in chronic osteomyelitis, 3. Necrotic bone providing a nidus for infection in chronic osteomyelitis, 4. Healthy bone adjacent to chronic osteomyelitis, and 5. Healthy bone adjacent to acute osteomyelitis. So sequestrum is defined as the necrotic bone which has become walled off or sequestered from its blood supply and can present as a nidus for chronic osteomyelitis. Involucrum is a layer of new bone growth outside existing bone seen in osteomyelitis. In chronic osteomyelitis, the periosteum is elevated away from the cortical bone by the accumulation of pus leaking from the sequestrum. New bone develops from the periosteum, forming the involucrum. So the correct answer to this question is 3. A sequestrum is defined as a necrotic bone providing a nidus for infection in chronic osteomyelitis. Next question. In a child with acute hematogenous osteomyelitis, what test is most likely to be abnormal? And the choices are 1. White blood cell count, 2. Blood culture, 3. Bone culture, 4. Thyroid function test, and 5. C-reactive protein. So acute hematogenous osteomyelitis affects 1 in 5,000 children, and historically, prior to antibiotics, that is, nearly half died due to the disease. Fortunately, the mortality rate is much lower today, at less than 1%, but prompt diagnosis and treatment is critical to decrease the morbidity of this disease. Often, many of the laboratory values may not be elevated, and cultures may not be positive. In fact, the white blood cell count and cultures, even bone cultures, are positive less than half of the time. The erythrocyte sedimentation rate is positive over 90% of the time, and often highly elevated, but does not peak for 3 to 5 days. The C-reactive protein, however, is elevated in 98% of patients with acute hematogenous osteomyelitis, and decreases quickly after appropriate antibiotic therapy. The differential diagnosis of acute hematogenous osteomyelitis is long and includes bony tumors and leukemia, which should be considered, especially if the child fails to respond to appropriate treatment. But the correct answer to this question is 5, C-reactive protein. Next question. You were asked to consult on a 4-day-old neonate admitted because of failure to thrive. She has swelling of her left shoulder. Examination reveals limited motion of her hips and the left shoulder. Radiographs of the shoulder and pelvis are negative. Laboratory studies show a white blood cell count of 24,000, an erythrocyte sedimentation rate of 50 per hour, and a C-reactive protein is 16.4. What is the next most appropriate step in management? And the choices are 1. Ultrasound of the hip and shoulder, 2. Bone scan, 3. MRI of the shoulder, 4. Pavlik harness, and 5. Excision and drainage. So ultrasound of both the hip and the shoulder can show the presence of septic arthritis and osteomyelitis. Multiple sites of infection are common in neonates. A bone scan can be used to identify other areas of involvement, but the correct answer to this question is 1. Ultrasound of the hip and shoulder. Next question. A 2-year-old girl has a 2-day history of fever and refuses to move her left shoulder following varicella. Laboratory studies show an erythrocyte sedimentation rate of 75 millimeters per hour and a peripheral white blood cell count of 18,000. What is the most common organism in this scenario? And the choices are 1. Kingella kingae, 2. Group A beta hemolytic streptococcus, 3. Group B streptococcus, 4, staph epidermidis, and 5, staph aureus. So this is kind of a tough question. The most common bacterial etiologic agent following a varicella infection is actually group A beta hemolytic streptococcus. The other organisms are much less common, so this is something that you just have to know. Staph aureus is obviously the most common bone infection organism, but for this question was the most common wrong answer. Staphylococcus epidermidis is increasingly a bone infection organism. Group B streptococcus occurs more commonly in newborns, and Kingella kingae is a common joint pathogen, but is not as common following varicella. So again, the correct answer to this question is 2, group A beta hemolytic streptococcus after a varicella infection. Next question. In which of the following patients with osteomyelitis of the tibia is surgical debridement the next best step in treatment? And the choices are 1, a 9-year-old girl with new onset pain and fever, 2, a 7-year-old lethargic boy with a CRP of 20 that does not decline after a week of napsilin and vancomycin, 3, a 7-year-old girl with 3 days of pain, fever, and a white blood cell count of 21,000 who presents to the ER, 4, an 8-year-old boy whose pain and fever have decreased after 24 hours of ampicillin, 5, an 8-year-old lethargic girl with a white blood cell count of 21,000 and a CRP of 9 after 24 hours of gentamicin. So surgery is indicated in scenario 2, as the patient has failed to respond to appropriate antibiotic treatment for osteomyelitis. Other surgical indications for osteomyelitis are the aspiration of pus from bone and the presence of a subperiosteal abscess. In the review by Song and Slobida, the authors note that staph aureus accounts for greater than 90% of osteomyelitis in children of all age groups. The authors recommend 3 to 4 weeks of antibiotics while following the response to therapy with CRP levels. The patients in scenarios 1 and 3 have not had a trial of antibiotic treatment, thus surgery is not yet indicated. The patient in scenario 4 is clinically improving after 24 hours of antibiotics, presumably a sensitive strain, and the patient in scenario 5 has not yet failed appropriate antibiotic treatment, as gentamicin does not effectively treat gram-positive organisms such as staph aureus. So again, the correct answer to this question is 2, surgical debridement is the next best step for a 7-year-old lethargic boy with a CRP of 20 milligrams per liter that does not decline after a week of napsilin and vancomycin. Next question. Septic arthritis in pediatric patients may occur secondary to direct intra-articular spread from metaphyseal osteomyelitis. This can occur in all of the following joints except, and the choices are 1, the hip, 2, the ankle, 3, the shoulder, 4, the elbow, and 5, the knee. So bones with an intra-articular metaphysis are the proximal humerus, proximal radius, proximal femur, and distal fibula slash tibia. This makes the shoulder, elbow, hip, and ankle potential sources of septic arthritis secondary to direct metaphyseal spread of osteomyelitis. The metaphysis of the knee is extra-articular, and as such, proximal tibial or distal femur osteomyelitis does not routinely spread to the knee. So anyway, the correct answer to this question is 5, the knee, as septic arthritis in pediatric patients secondary to direct intra-articular spread from metaphyseal osteomyelitis does not spread to the knee, unlike the other joints listed. And the final question for this topic, a 6-year-old boy develops tenderness at the right heel and avoids putting weight on the right extremity after stepping on a nail 2 weeks ago while wearing tennis shoes. His mother notes that he has had a fever of 39 degrees Celsius. Calcaneal osteomyelitis caused by a puncture wound has an increased rate of which of the following compared to hematogenous osteomyelitis? And the choices are 1, presence of group A streptococcus infection, 2, presence of coliforms infection, 3, presence of hemophilus infection, 4, presence of pseudomonas infection, and 5, presence of group B strep infection. So calcaneal osteomyelitis in children can occur via hematogenous seeding or direct puncture wounds. There are 2 types of pediatric hematogenous osteomyelitis, and those are acute and subacute hematogenous osteomyelitis. The most common organism identified is Staph aureus, according to Blythe et al., and is found in 70% of the cases. The article by Karwowska et al. Reviewed 146 osteomyelitis cases and noted that tenderness was the most common sign, while fever and decreased limb use were the most common symptoms. Miller's review states that group A strep and coliforms were less common organisms, and with recent immunization programs, Haemophilus influenza is almost eradicated as an osteomyelitis etiology. However, the etiology of calcaneal osteomyelitis due to puncture wounds is different. The article by Puffenbarger et al. Found a 100% incidence of Pseudomonas infection in their calcaneal osteomyelitis cases caused by puncture wounds, as in this patient's case. So the correct answer to this question is 4, presence of Pseudomonas infection. Moving on to the final topic of biopsy principles. The first question reads, a 29-year-old man complains of a painful left distal thigh and knee pain. Imaging reveals a lesion in the distal femoral metaphysis extending into the lateral femoral condyle. An incisional biopsy is planned for this mass in the distal femur. Which of the following is recommended regarding treatment of these lesions? And the choices are 1. Incisional biopsy using an anterior longitudinal incision through an intramuscular plane. 2. Incisional biopsy using a lateral longitudinal incision through an intermuscular plane. 3. Incisional biopsy using a lateral longitudinal incision through an intramuscular plane. 4. Arthroscopic guided biopsy using a lateral medial parapatellar keyhole incision. And 5. Arthroscopic guided biopsy using medial and lateral parapatellar keyhole incisions. So, incisional biopsy should be performed using a direct lateral longitudinal incision through an intramuscular plane, taking care to stay away from important neurovascular structures. So, the correct answer to this question is 3, incisional biopsy using a lateral longitudinal incision through an intramuscular plane. But to quickly review, when performing an incisional biopsy, important principles to remember to minimize contamination and make subsequent surgical resection less challenging and less morbid are 1. Longitudinal extensile incision and no transverse incisions. 2. Use an intramuscular plane to minimize the number of muscle compartments resected. 3. Do not violate the joint where possible. 4. Avoid dissection close to nerve/vessel, as these structures will then have to be resected subsequently. 5. Avoid biopsy through and later resection of the quadriceps where possible. 6. If using a drain, bring it out in line with the incision. And 7. Meticulous hemostasis and close the tumor pseudocapsule. But to quickly go over the incorrect answers for this question, answer 1 is incorrect because an anterior approach would lead to contamination of the quadriceps and subsequent resection of the quadriceps is highly morbid. Answer 2 is incorrect because an intermuscular plane would lead to contamination of greater than one muscle belly and necessitate resection of said muscles in the ensuing surgical resection. And answers 4 and 5 are incorrect because contamination of the knee joint should be avoided. Next question. A 53-year-old female presents to your community hospital with right shoulder pain of 2 weeks' duration, night sweats, and loss of appetite. Her past medical history is significant for hypertension only. A radiograph is performed and shows an ill-defined lytic lesion of the proximal humerus. The lytic appearance with cortical expansion suggests a malignant and aggressive process. The calcifications suggest a chondroid tumor and raises the suspicion of a high-grade chondrosarcoma. What is the most appropriate next step in management? And the choices are 1, observation, 2, blood cultures, 3, a CT-guided biopsy, 4, hemiarthroplasty, and 5, referral to an orthopedic oncologist. So the clinical presentation is consistent with a malignant bone lesion. Referral to an orthopedic oncologist is the most appropriate next step in management, both in real life and in this question, making answer 5 the correct choice in this question. Biopsy of soft tissue and bone lesions is a difficult procedure that is fraught with complications if obtained improperly. Occasionally, improperly performed biopsies may preclude limb salvage, thus greatly altering the outcome of the disease process, And because of this, it is considered standard of care to refer patients with possible musculoskeletal tumors to treatment centers capable of proper diagnosis and management of the condition. While a community orthopedic surgeon may very well know how to properly biopsy a lesion, it is in the patient's best interest to be referred to a treatment center prior to biopsy if that surgeon does not feel comfortable managing the patient afterwards. Mankin et al. Review 597 musculoskeletal oncology cases to determine the complications associated with biopsies. Of the 597 patients reviewed, 282, that is 47.2% of the patients, had the procedure at a referring institution. Out of all the biopsies, he found a 17.8% rate of diagnostic error, a 19.3% chance of an incorrectly performed biopsy causing a change in management, and a 3% incidence of an unnecessary amputation being performed. So to quickly review the incorrect answers, answer 1 is incorrect because observation would not be appropriate as the clinical presentation is consistent for a malignant lesion. Answer 2 is incorrect because the clinical presentation is not consistent with infection, so blood cultures would not be indicated. Answer 3 is incorrect because a biopsy should be postponed until the patient is referred to an oncology center for the reasons we just discussed. And answer 4 is incorrect because a diagnosis must be established with proper staging prior to any treatment like a hemiarthroplasty. And the final question for this topic, which of the following is an important factor in performing a proper biopsy? And the choices are 1. Staying carefully in the proper intermuscular planes. 2. Placing multiple drains. 3. Dissecting and protecting critical neurovascular structures. 4. Using longitudinal incisions in the extremity. And 5. Avoiding the use of a tourniquet. So there are a number of important technical details in performing a biopsy. Incisions should always be longitudinal in the extremity. Good hemostasis is important in avoiding contamination from hematoma. The approach should avoid neurovascular structures and go through a single muscle belly whenever possible. And although a frozen section should be obtained to ensure adequate viable tissue has been obtained, definitive diagnosis is not necessary at the time of the frozen section. So the correct answer to this question is 4. Using longitudinal incisions in the extremity is an important factor in performing a biopsy. That's all for this question review session about lumbar spine anatomy, pediatric osteomyelitis, and biopsy principles. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.